From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 8 years after one of the worst acts of genocide in the 20th century, Rwanda is walking an ancient path to justice. The government has revived the Gacaca court system, where village elders replace lawyers and international judges. But will communal justice bring community healing? This hour, killers, survivors, village elders, and world-class genocide. We begin tonight with the latest on the wildfires that have scorched more than 136,000 acres in Colorado. Fires are also burning out of control in California, New Mexico, Utah, and Arizona. In a Colorado courtroom yesterday, Terry Barton, the Forest Service worker who confessed to starting the fire, pleaded not guilty to 4 counts in a federal indictment against her. Denver Post columnist Diane Carman has been writing about the emotional impact of the fire. Earlier, she put the incredible pictures we've seen of the fires into words.
It's an amazing, hot, awful fire. Very, very hard to control. Conditions are awfully dry here. It's about 35 miles away from the city, so we get a lot of smoke and ash and things like that. Here in Denver, that's really the only impact we have. In those mountain communities, it's just awful, though. A lot of them are living in high school gymnasiums and campers parked out in the middle of nowhere, you know. Tens of thousands of people have been evacuated, and some of them are being allowed to return to their homes, but a lot of them are still stuck.
Diane Carman, you've written in your column that the fire has devoured homes and dreams. Share some of those stories with us.
Among the people that I talked to was a couple from Lawrence, Kansas, who had all their lives, when they first got married 35 years ago, they had fallen in love with the Colorado mountains, and they'd always wanted to own a place back in the mountains in the forest, and they kind of saved, and, you know, they had kids, and things got postponed. But finally, a year ago, they went in together with some old friends, and they bought a place in the mountains, and that area was engulfed by the fire this week. It was really quite a sad story. The woman was telling me about how she was calling every day, and as long as she'd get the answering machine with the recording of her voice on it, she knew the place was okay.
Was still there. Oh, my goodness.
And finally, she made a call on Tuesday, and the phone just rang and rang, and she knew something bad had happened. Well, among the other stories that are really sad is there are people who own little dude ranches, and this is not only their home, but it's their livelihood, and they have worked really hard over the years to develop a tourism business and the livestock, and a lot of them have been severely affected, if not completely destroyed.
What do Denver residents think of people who build homes or second homes up in the woods? Do they think, gee, that could have been me, and it's a darn shame they lost their house?
Well, I got to tell you, I think all of us suffer from real ambiguous feelings, ambivalent feelings about this. Every one of us can sit back here and say, well, it's their own damn fault. They took the risk. They built in a fire zone. They knew all along that this could happen. But it's like somebody who builds in a 100-year floodplain. You always think it's not going to happen to you. And then there's the other aspect of this from the standpoint of the Denver resident. Most people who move to Denver, Colorado, do it because they love the mountains. And so I think there is a great deal of sympathy for the people who are living there, because most of us really have a deep affection for that part of the world.
And there, but for the grace of God, goes almost anyone in Denver.
You got it.
Yesterday, Terry Barton, the forest ranger who started the fire, apparently was indicted. Prosecutors portrayed her as an unstable firebug. What are your impressions of her? We're trying to figure this woman out from a distance.
I think the whole country is trying to figure this woman out. She is a tragic figure in many ways, had a somewhat tragic childhood. There were allusions in court to a sexual assault when she was young, but no actual descriptions or specific information about that. We know that her family was quite poor, and things ended up falling to her responsibilities at a very early age. We know that her estranged husband had a drinking problem, and she was extremely unhappy. So they painted a picture of a woman who had a lot of troubles. They also had the defense brought in long line of people who defended her, including a firefighter who had come from the work in the fire lines in this fire. they just said she was a loving, kind, generous person who the community responded to. She was always the first one to volunteer to help. They really were genuinely effusive in their praise and affection for her. So,
but she's burned down a big chunk of Colorado.
Isn't that amazing? It is amazing. And I think what we're all struggling with here is trying to figure out what could possibly motivate someone who obviously enjoyed the forest. She was working for the Forest Service, who is obviously a kind, loving person, who is a part of that community that was so threatened and endangered by this. What on earth would make her do this?
And what's the best theory of the case that you've heard, Diana?
There is a suggestion that she really needed some attention. She needed validation. And possibly she started this fire in an attempt to look like a hero so that she could put the fire out, come back, and have everybody kind of commend her for this. There's also the suggestion that she wanted a promotion. She wanted to go to fire investigator school, and so maybe she would look like a good candidate if she had detected this fire early and put it out.
Is Colorado ever going to forgive her?
People are very puzzled by this. I think there's anger, but there's more just bewilderment at what on earth she was thinking.
Diane Carman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Diane Carman is a columnist for the Denver Post. The very worst offenders in the Rwandan genocide are facing an international criminal tribunal in nearby Tanzania. But Rwanda's genocide was one of neighbors killing neighbors. 8 years after the killing, over 100,000 alleged murderers, accomplices, and looters await trial in horrific Rwandan jails. At the current rate of trials, Rwandan officials say it would take over 200 years to reach verdicts for them all. The country can't wait that long. So the Rwandan government has revived an ancient system of communal justice. In the Kinyarwanda language, it's called gachacha. In English, it means justice on the grass. Over the past several months, the government has trained nearly a 250,000 people to serve in village courts. And this week, the gachacha process went into full swing. In the aftermath of genocide, can village elders dole out justice as effectively as Western-style lawyers and judges? Can they do it more effectively? Can the wisdom of elders on a town green deal with genocide that drenched those greens in blood? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Peter Uvin. He's a professor for international humanitarian studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University and author of Aiding Violence, the Development Enterprise in Rwanda. Good evening and welcome, Peter Uvin.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Peter Uvin, be good enough to take us in very brief to the history here. How did we end up with 100,000 plus Rwandans in jails or prison camps? What kind of trials have they faced so far? And why has the country turned to this traditional, very old style of justice called gachacha?
Well, the genocide basically ended because a rebel army named the FPR, the rebel patriotic front that came from Uganda, and it was primarily, although not exclusively, composed of Tutsi against whom the genocide was being committed. Mm-hmm. They basically conquered power and ended the genocide.
This after numbers vary, but around 800,000 Tutsi and some liberal-minded Hutu had been slaughtered.
Quite correct. Numbers vary between 500,000 and 800,000. The lower end is probably slightly more correct.
Okay.
Thousands, if not tens of thousands, of Hutu indeed also died, but not because of their ethnicity, but rather because they were in the way, indeed. So often people talk about the genocide and the massacres, the genocide referring to the Tutsi, mm-hmm. and the massacres to the Hutu who were being killed.
But we're talking about 500,000 people, at the least in any case, and many of these killings were neighbor on neighbor, were done with machetes.
Correct, yes. They were organized from above by a state intent on destroying an entire ethnic group of its own population. And by the way, it was extremely successful in that. Mm-hmm. About 70-80% of all Tutsi living in Rwanda at the time were killed. And had the FPR not stopped it, undoubtedly they would have reached the full 100%. So it was organized by the state from above, but it was done with active and massive participation by indeed tens and tens and tens of thousands of ordinary people.
Which left Rwanda with a very unique circumstance where a very significant percentage of the country was implicated one way or another in the slaughter of their fellow countrymen.
Indeed, and it is quite unique.
And so people in the aftermath were herded into prison camps practically and have sat there, most of them, for 8 years.
Yes. After the genocide, the government argued that Rwanda would never be able to escape the cycles of violence it had gone through. There had been some violence in past mm-hmm. decades as well, although never on the scale. It would never be able to escape those cycles of violence until it once and for all broke what it called a cycle of impunity. And this impunity was precisely that in Rwanda you could kill, especially along ethnic lines, without ever facing any consequences. Mm. So they argued we really need full and complete justice to once and for all show that this is not going to be the case anymore in Rwanda. And so they set out indeed to imprison people, but in the meantime they had an extremely ill-functioning, if not almost totally absent, justice, police and investigative system. So many, indeed, they had hardly any files, any capacity to check on accusations, unbelievably mm-hmm. awful prison conditions.
Peter Juven, I remember I was in Rwanda after the genocide and was told at that time that there was not a single functioning court remaining and very few surviving judges.
That's very correct. And in that respect, the international community and the Western donor countries have contributed big time in helping Rwanda rebuild courts, retrain judges, retrain policemen, retrain investigators, build, you know, the whole necessary infrastructure to get something like a justice system.
But apparently it hasn't been quite enough. Why has the country now turned to the more traditional system of justice called Gacaca?
Well, the main practical reason is indeed speed, i.e., even with the whole system rebuilt to some extent, we are still talking about one of the 10 poorest countries in the world mm-hmm. trying to face one of the most horrific and massive crimes in the history that, you know, of the 20th century. And so the system, the formal justice system, bringing people to real adversarial trials mm-hmm. with lawyers there and files and the whole works, mm-hmm. and it just takes very, very long. So the current speed of the justice system is about 1,500 persons a year.
And with over 100,000 people, that will take a long time.
Yes, and that's without appeals. So
the Rwandan President Paul Kagame has said that they need the traditional court system to deal with that, and also to show, to quote him, that the Rwandan family is capable of solving its own problems. What's the history of this traditional system of justice?
Yeah, let me just step back then. So the speed mm-hmm. and speeding up this thing and getting rid of that problem is number one. Mm-hmm. But indeed, number two would be not only would it do the same thing as a formal justice system does, mm-hmm. but faster, but possibly it would do something more as well, something that would involve communities, that would involve ordinary people. Because it is clear that the formal justice system also, it takes place in these courtrooms in provincial capitals. It's not something that most ordinary Rwandans, who are extremely poor farmers living far away, have any connection to. The language, the formalities, it's all none of their thing. So in many ways it happens, if it happens, far away from them. Gacaca would also do better on that, supposedly.
Because it's to be carried out in public gatherings in the villages where the crimes were committed.
Correct. In front of everybody where it happened, with the people to whom it happened, if they still live.
What's the background of this system? How does it work?
Well, in many ways, this is not at all anymore the original Gacaca system. The name is actually the only thing that's truly continuity from the past. Because evidently such a traditional system as it used to exist never was designed to deal with any crimes of this magnitude.
The scale.
Mm. Yes, and neither could it. I mean, it wasn't just made for dealing with murder and that kind of stuff. It was indeed, as you said in your introduction, about elders, wise men who would indeed mediate and typically find symbolic kind of judgments involving actually, you know, some mutual sharing of beer more often than not.
Mm, but in this case, it won't only be men, maybe not even elders, and it's been revamped. We're going to come back and talk exactly about how it works. It is something to see, a nation, as you say, one of the world's poorest, trying to deal with crime on this scale. Does every trial around the world, even for genocide, require Western-style justice? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about communal justice in Rwanda, where 8 years ago, an epic act of genocide took place. Now a small and poor country is trying to deal with finding justice and maybe reconciliation when more than 100,000 Rwandans still await trial. The question is, when the crime is genocide and thousands were killers, what is justice and who can best deliver it? Are there times when village elders, communal trials can deliver justice more effectively than an international tribunal? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Peter Yuvin. He's Associate Professor for International Humanitarian Studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Peter Yuvin, you began to tell us exactly how this works. Give us, in brief, how will this work? I know the most serious crimes, the masterminds, the worst actors in this whole genocide will still be tried not in the Gacaca courts, but in more formal courts. How exactly will the Gacaca courts work?
There were elections a few months ago in which throughout the country people chose Gacaca judges on the local level. Now, Rwanda is divided in a whole administrative structure that has at the lowest level things called cells. Cells are a few hundreds of families, no more than that, a good neighborhood here in the U.S. And so each of these cells chose its own judges, 19 of them.
And now they're waiting for the people who committed murder and other crimes in their community to come back and stand trial.
Correct. The idea is that, and by the way, so there are gachachas at the level of all these cells. Mm-hmm. Then there are gachachas again. That's about 9,000 cells. So each of them with about 19 judges, make a fast calculation, about 170,000 judges out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then at the next level, the sector, you have about 1,500 of these gachacha courts. At the next level, the district, you have a good 100 more, 106 to be.
And presumably the higher level courts will handle the higher level crimes.
That's the idea, indeed. And each higher up level also judges the appeals of the lower level.
What are the village level courts' options in terms of sentences?
It actually goes into two phases. And the first phase is actually by far the most important. Because in the first phase, every person currently accused of genocide, and currently indeed somewhere in prison, will be brought to the cell where supposedly the crime took place.
Mm-hmm.
And be basically put in front of the entire assembly of everybody of that cell. And people will start talking. That's the idea. So they will start talking about it. The person can say, well, the person can start by confessing. This is very important as well.
And President Kagame has encouraged the accused to just come and confess.
Absolutely.
And ask forgiveness.
There are very significant penalty reductions if you confess.
Mm-hmm.
Very significant. For example, at the level of murder, which is probably the most common of the accusations,
mm-hmm.
You could get life if you were found guilty without having confessed at all. But you would get 7 years only if you were found guilty having confessed before the trial started.
This is serious business. What is your level of confidence that there will be something like justice done uniformly or in the main? Or might some of these people just be... What's to keep the village from pouncing on these people and tearing them to pieces? They did terrible things.
Absolutely. The main strength of it supposedly is that everybody could be there. Folks from all sides, people who actually want the defendant to go free because they might think that he or she is honestly innocent, or maybe they're even just simply family members or accomplices, and people who think that the defendant indeed ought not to go free because they think that truly this person committed a horrible crime. And then the defendant himself, of course, because they're almost all male, has to, you know, come to grips with his own conscience as well. Let's face it, and even develop a sort of a strategy. Do I confess or do I not confess? And as a little aside, a confession has to be complete, which means you have to mention every person who was with you during the crime, which may mean that you really start implicating other people as well, some of whom, by the way, might be free, might be out there in the village.
So even free people. And as we read the outcome of these trials, where these are people returning to their homes where they've been absent and where there's long-standing ethnic tension, could change the balance of power between tribal groups, between family groups within any given community.
Yes. Well, but to step back, how it would function then is that everybody basically, by and large, has an enormous incentive to talk.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not always the truth, evidently, but in any case, to speak. And in the confrontation of these various opinions, I did not do it, but he did it. Wait a minute, and so on. It's not really true. They did it together, and so on. Out of this whole confrontation of ideas and opinions and defenses and accusations, supposedly, after some time, a truth will emerge. And pre-gachachas that have been taking place until now have actually been not bad at all. Truth did emerge. After some time, a sense of the whole community agreeing on a sort of a balance that he was really responsible, he just followed, mm-hmm. and these two guys did do actually nothing at all, emerged, with often the prisoners themselves actually also agreeing with that sort of a scale and of complicity.
And maybe out of that, at some point, a satisfactory sense of justice and maybe even reconciliation. Peter Yuvan, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Priscilla Hayner. Priscilla Hayner is program director at the International Center for Transitional Justice. She's author of Unspeakable Truths, Confronting State Terror and Atrocities. Good evening and welcome, Priscilla Hayner.
Good evening. Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us. Priscilla Hayner, you write about transitional justice in settings around the world where there have been calamities along the lines of Rwanda's, or perhaps different, but still where societies have come apart. What exactly is transitional justice?
Well, transitional justice is a new field, or it's a field that's increasingly gaining attention around the world, and the term is being used more frequently today, which is essentially a basket of policy options or mechanisms that can be turned to promote accountability, to achieve accountability at a point of transition in a society after a period of vast human rights violations and atrocities.
So transition from chaos and crime to some more stable order and reconciliation?
Following a civil war, following authoritarian regime, following other kind of abusive powers that may be, there is a need, of course, to both take stock, to promote justice on an individual level, to promote reconciliation, which may mean many different things to different people, to establish the truth, to provide reparations for victims, and, of course, to reform institutions as necessary to prevent future violations.
And it's not just Rwanda, obviously. There have been many settings around the world in the last few decades where I suppose you end up needing transitional justice.
Well, there have been many over the last decades, and there are many very much today, actively, and each and every case is different from the others. Rwanda is a very good example, as Peter Yuvan has described, of the very difficult challenges that confront these kinds of societies. But you can turn to Sierra Leone, to East Timor, to Peru, even places like Mexico, which has gone through its own kind of transition over the last couple of years. All of them and many others around the world, other countries, are reaching out to ask, well, yes, we know we want justice in the courts and we will do everything we can to get justice in the courts, but what else can we do to respond to the needs of victims, to promote some sort of healing within our society? And it's a very difficult challenge, but certainly there have been many lessons learned looking to places like South Africa, looking to places like El Salvador or Argentina.
I wonder if Rwanda is unusual in reaching back to a traditional form of justice, to communal justice, to deal, in this case, with the volume of trial work that's necessary.
Rwanda is unique in the sense of the great numbers that society is facing in terms of the numbers of perpetrators that are already in detention, in addition to others that probably aren't in detention that could be brought into the process, and the huge number of victims. And again, that has been described in your show by Peter Yuvan already. Now, if you look to other societies, they're confronting similar questions, but in a less extreme form. In other words, they may not have 500 or 800,000 killed, and they may not have 110,000 or so in prison, but they may have tens of thousands that were killed or disappeared, and they may have thousands or hundreds of perpetrators or accused, and even that number is too many for them to grapple with in the courts.
We've heard so much about South Africa's truth and reconciliation committees, but the Rwandan situation is different. They're not just trying to get the truth out and absolve everyone. These are judicial proceedings with sentences and punishments at the end.
Rwanda is doing something different. And as people say, it's an experiment that we must watch. It's been argued, and I think very effectively so, that it's not the Gacaca system that's being put forward and is now starting is clearly not a perfect system. And I'm sure that there will be problems or abuses in it, and there will be wrongs that take place in how people are accused or how the truth is come to. On the other hand, the current situation is also very much unperfect.
And what do you see as the strengths and weaknesses of this kind of traditional communal justice, where the elders, or in this case the newly elected and briefly trained community judges, pass judgment on people who may have slaughtered a bunch of their own village?
Well, as has been said, it's important that this is brought to the community level. And if you look at other societies as well, Mozambique, Sierra Leone, East Timor, I could give specific examples where those societies have indigenous processes in place, and they have turned to them and are now turning to them when they need to grapple with these kinds of crimes in the past. It's not sufficient alone, but to allow the communities to take part in the process, and especially to create some sort of process. It is not simply allowing thousands of people, in the case of Rwanda, to languish in jail without any foreseeable time when they might come to court. So, as Peter Juven said, in order to speed up the process, one must look to alternative mechanisms. You can't rely only on the purely judicial approach. And at the same time, you try to create the complementary or alternative system in a way that allows communities to take part in the process in a very positive way, and hopefully to promote reconciliation on a very real level at the local level.
We're talking about communal justice in Rwanda. Does Western-style justice leave room for reconciliation? And what if village justice degenerates into crimes of its own, into counter-genocide? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Frederick is on the line. Welcome, Frederick. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello. Good evening.
Yeah, good evening, Tom. My name is Frederick Massini. I'm from Congo.
All right. The neighboring neighboring country to Rwanda.
Yes, neighbor country of Rwanda.
And very much involved with each other, we note as well, Congo
yes,
and Rwanda.
Yes, Mr. Tom, I intervened in this topic because I want to correct many things that I hear through this radio.
We're listening, Frederick.
Okay. First of all, we have to understand what is Rwanda. Rwanda is a small country. If you check on the map, you can't find Rwanda in the map. It's like a little point.
We've been there. We know it's small. What does it matter?
Two tribes. Let me explain to you. We've just two tribes, only two tribes.
The Hutu and the Tutsi.
Tutsi and Hutu.
Yes.
Hutu are majority.
Yes.
Like United States, black and white. White are majority.
Mm-hmm.
In Rwanda, Tutsi are majority.
Take us to your point, Frederick.
My point is like this. This kind of justice that Kagame is making now in Rwanda is very dangerous for the future of this country.
And why?
Because why? Let me explain to you first. How genocide, because we have to go to the root of the problems. How genocide that you call genocide in Rwanda occur? The guy who was in the power, Habyarimana, he came from a peace talk with Kagame. Kagame was rebels. He came from a peace talk.
We recall his plane was shot down, and it all began.
His plane was shot by Kagame's army.
Frederick, I don't want to recount every bit of this history, but I want you to take us to your core concern or issue.
The issue is we can't understand a tribunal with more than 200 people and it's going to take more than 200 years in a country only with two tribes. They need reconciliation between two tribes.
Are you concerned, Frederick, that justice will not be done in these communal?
Outside. They put them outside because they're Tutsi.
Frederick, I want to ask you a simple question. Are you concerned that justice will not be done in these community council courts?
No, you can't root justice in the system. You can't. Kagame is doing very bad thing. He's a criminal guy. He's like Hitler. He's killing people for nothing.
Frederick, are you may I ask, are you Hutu?
I'm not Hutu. I'm from Congo. I'm telling you, I'm from Congo. My country is rich. Rwanda is nothing to me. Rwanda is like garbage for me.
But
my country is rich.
Did you say
Rwanda
garbage? Frederick, thank you for your call. I want to turn to Peter Yuvin. And Peter, you know the Rwanda situation well, and you can hear the passion in Frederick's view here. I guess a couple things. One, what is your level of confidence that this will we know the kind of animosity that must remain here. Entire families wiped out, extended families wiped out. The rage must still be deep. Can Hutu accused of these crimes count on anything like justice occurring in that environment? And secondly, does this stand a chance of healing the rift between these tribal groups with such longstanding animosity? Or is this just going to be seen by the Hutus as another, Tutsi slap in the face?
Yeah, that's difficult indeed. Clearly, nothing is going to be easy in Rwanda after a genocide. There could be justice to some extent. Yes, absolutely. And it actually depends. And that's what happens with these kinds of informal, decentralized systems, of course. You can't predict it exactly. It will depend to no small extent of the kind of local dynamics. Are there enough people willing to speak the truth? Are pressures not being exerted on people in key positions to try to intimidate others and so on? If things go okay, and they could go okay, and until now, actually, in quite a few of the pre-Gachachas, things have gone decently well, this could yield something that actually may well be justice indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does this lead to a reconciliation? No, let me backtrack one moment. Things could also not go okay. Absolutely. And there's no way of knowing this in advance. There could be cellules or cells where people will be put under pressure, where corruption might take place. Evidently, by the way, there was the same with the formal justice system as well.
Can the Gachacha sentence a person to death?
No, it cannot. And there is appeal. So the government says, you know, there is appeal possible, and so it is a pretty secure system. It is not the worst possible system at all, and it has some potential great benefits. It is risky.
Mm. Priscilla Heiner, you've also paid attention here. Our caller, I was struck by how he casually called Rwanda garbage. We know that the genocide began with the radios saying that the Tutsis were cockroaches to be stamped out. This kind of dehumanization has often preceded genocide, has it not?
It has. It's very unfortunate, and you see it continuing in some places or with some people. I think that's in a sense what points to the very challenge before us and before these societies. It's, as you say, the animosity continues, and we should expect the animosity to continue. We should expect anger and great trauma and sadness. And even in the best of circumstances, even with very formal and fairly broad trials where those societies are lucky enough to have systems to do that, that will not take care of that anger. And even with a successful Gachacha system, it will move Rwanda forward, I think. And I think, as Peter Yuvin said, there will be potentially some great successes and also some challenges to it.
Not easy to climb back out of the hole of genocide. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about communal justice in Rwanda. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about communal justice in Rwanda, a country 8 years ago racked with genocide that killed more than 500,000 Rwandans, now trying to deal with a backlog of more than 100,000 accused awaiting trial by sending them back to their home villages, where many were slaughtered, for people there to decide what should be done with them. What do you think? When the crime is genocide and thousands were killers, what is justice? And who can best deliver it? Are there times when village elders, communal trials, can deliver justice more effectively than an international tribunal when they're the only way? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Peter Yuvin. He's Associate Professor for International Humanitarian Studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. And by Priscilla Heiner. She's Program Director at the International Center for Transitional Justice and author of Unspeakable Truths, Confronting State Terror and Atrocities. And joined now by Ken Harrow. He's Rwanda Country Specialist for Amnesty International. He's a professor at Michigan State University. Good evening and welcome, Ken Harrow.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for joining us, Ken. Ken Harrow, Amnesty International has put out a press release this week that outlined concerns about the Gacaca courts in Rwanda. What's Amnesty International worried about here?
Well, I think your guests have expressed them largely. It's concerned that there be fair trials, that the circumstances under which the trials take place are such that the defendants are not intimidated, that the witnesses that they might wish to call aren't intimidated. It's a very simple, I think, bottom-line notion of fairness in the trials themselves.
But I would think Amnesty International's view of this couldn't be very simple, because even the prison conditions under which they're being held as they await trials might draw your attention on another day. How do you weigh off the precise degree of confidence in justice versus people languishing for years and years and years in very poor prison conditions?
You're absolutely right. And if you look at Amnesty's press release, it begins not with a negative rejection of the Gacaca system, but rather a recognition that it's an opportunity for justice to actually take place. But the problem is that we can't go into it blind, as it were. That is, we can't immediately assume, because they're turning to this system, that the problems involved in justice are going to be easily taken care of. I think we have to be very careful to make sure that there's a monitoring process.
Will there be a monitoring process, Ken Harrow?
Yes, that there be some kind of monitoring of the Gacaca hearings themselves.
But is that planned? Will there be such monitoring?
They haven't really given any kind of indication. There's been lots of international assistance offered to the Rwandans for justice. One way in which assistance could be made would be to have independent monitors observing these trials to make sure that there's some transparency and that they're fair.
Are you concerned that this whole process could sort of slip into reverse gear and turn into a kind of reverse genocide or killings?
Absolutely not.
Good.
I really am not. I think that this is a decent attempt. I would back away from describing this as in the summary way you've been doing, by talking about village elders, and recognize that there was an elective process where they're trying to put people here. Maybe if you think about it, the way in which we have a jury system, also we bring the community into play in making decisions over justice.
Yeah, Peter Yuvin was more clear on that, and that's an important point. Mm-hmm. Ken Harrow, thanks for being with us tonight.
You're welcome. May I add one more?
Yes,
one
please.
More concern that Amnesty has that I think is it perhaps hasn't come in quite yet as much as it might. Mm-hmm. That is, this whole system should be viewed, I think, within the context of the Rwandans' actions, not just internally, but also externally. That is, the Rwandan government is at play in Congo.
You mean the military intervention in Congo?
The intervention and the effects that it's had, with millions of people who've died.
Who've been displaced, helping fuel a civil war there.
You could say more than helping fuel it. I think they've been actively involved in it. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that if this is a system set up by a government which is calling for a means of justice to deal with genocide, at the same time that government has to be amenable to charges that it itself has been responsible for human rights violations.
Just across the border. A fair point and a good one, and maybe an issue for another show. Ken Harrow, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
We're talking about communal justice in Rwanda. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Carol's on the line. Welcome, Carol. You're on the air.
Thanks. I was calling because, from my understanding, since the genocide, all the discussion about reconciliation has really gone on at the international level and the War Crimes Tribunal in Arusha. And I wonder to what degree, there has been much on the ground in Rwanda to prepare people there for the notion of reconciliation and for the notion of these trials. I mean, For the average Rwandan, what kind of sort of education has gone on to prepare people for what is to come in these trials?
It's a great question. Thank you for bringing it to us, Carol. Peter, you've been, how about it? Briefly, how have people been prepared to carry out the trials? And more broadly, do you see the government in Kigali sending out the message that this is a path to reconciliation, not revenge?
Since the genocide, since it came to power, the government in Kigali has very strongly adhered to an official line of unity in Rwanda. As a matter of fact, it has also declared strongly that every Rwandan is a Rwandan and not a Hutu and a Tutsi. It has wiped off the mention of ethnicity from the IDs that the Rwandans used to carry, IDs that allowed the genocide to unfold so efficiently. It has carried that message all across the country. Now, at the same time, however, this government is clearly dominated by only Tutsi. So there is a disjuncture there between its practice and its message. Understandable, maybe, but still very visible. Specifically, as regards Gacaca, this has been taken around as well. There have been mass campaigns through radio, through burgomasters and other administrative figures mm-hmm. who have been telling the story over and over. The U.S. government, for that matter, has actually supported this sensitization campaign, as it's called. Does everybody know clearly and exactly? Probably not. On the other hand, the Gacaca process as it unfolds is recognizable to Rwandans, even though it is not the traditional thing as it used to be. It is something that plays in a cultural repertoire that Rwandans understand and know. And they actually still do this, often spontaneously for small things.
And Priscilla Hainer, we just got a minute left, but put this quickly in a global context for us. Are we keeping up with the demands on justice globally when they overflow formal judicial capacity? Do we have a justice deficit?
We are facing challenges in a bunch of countries around the world where they are struggling to respond to the justice demands. And I think the question that Carol has put to us about reconciliation and where the population is at is a very important one, because I think we as the international community shouldn't be too quick to assume that reconciliation can flow easily or quickly. It's a hard, difficult, and personal process to obtain reconciliation after such atrocious acts in a society. And it can mean something different for different individuals and different societies and different communities. So to enter into a process that has reconciliation attached as one of its goals is something that almost by definition is going to be extremely difficult to achieve. And we have to recognize that it's a very long-term process. And in combining the need for justice in a real sense and the need to weave back together societies that have been just fundamentally torn apart.
Terribly torn apart. Priscilla Hainer, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Priscilla Hainer is Program Director at the International Center for Transitional Justice. And Peter Yuvin, thank you for being with us.
Pleasure.
Peter Yuvin is Associate Professor for International Humanitarian Studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's author of Aiding Violence, the Development Enterprise in Rwanda. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, community justice comes to America. This is On Point. Community justice is thriving in some parts of America. ROCA Incorporated, a nonprofit organization based in Chelsea, Massachusetts, has introduced the Circle Project as a means to achieve healing and justice among local youths and families. The approach is based on a Native American form of dispute resolution. Offenders, their families, and community members sit together in a circle. They burn sage or pray, but the end result is they talk about healing and justice. In this radio diary, Su Rumpong, the regional street work director with ROCA Inc., talks about the Circle Project and what it's done in his community.
It's a voluntary basis. Anyone is welcome to the circle. Normally, in a circle, we sit in circle, we set a chair in circle, and we have a sacred object in the middle. For us, in the circle process, is that we have ritual. And so we do music sometime with sage, and we do reading sometime, and we do prayer sometime. And people would put something that has significant meaning in that circle process. So if we're talking about healing, they probably have someone that's remind them of the strength, you know, to put in the circle. So because we're going to deal with some hard issues. And so it normally we have an opening and we have a closing. And the whole ideal of circle is that you can't get to a good place in a bad way. And so that when people are angry or frustrated or sad or emotionally dealing with a whole lot of stuff, that humanly, that we can't get to a good place in a bad way. So that when we start in a good way and end in a good way, that it made people feel good. And that when it made people feel good, that people always wanted to come back. So when we deal with hard issues or situations, that we always start in a good way and we always end in a good way.
Thank you.
There was a young man who was involved into a lot of gang activities. And this young man mean a lot to me. And he's kind of been in and out from the street. And what happened is that there's relationship issues going on that's not going so well. And this young man had pulled out a machete and, you know, chopped at the other, cut the other young man while they're in this dispute of argument. And in the process of that, his son was there to witness the whole thing. And then the police got, you know, arrested him, and there was a charge on him. And we did a circle for him, a pre-sentencing circle without involving the court or the criminal justice people. And so we asked this young man to do a circle for himself. And so he had agreed to us, you know, that he wanted to do a circle. And so we did that for him, and we came up with a reparation process that he's going to commit to do some work with young people on the street, that he committed to checking with us and that we checking with him. And so he went out to court, and he showed up to court, and the judge read the incident report, and the DA was there and so forth. And so the judge looked at him and said, well, this young man has to go to jail. I can't let him be on the street and so forth. He sent this young man to jail. And to me, I was really upset. I'm like, the judge doesn't know this young man. He's been through a lot, and he's been working on a lot of stuff. But for him, for this young man to say that that's okay, he said, I thank you for all of your support. And I thank you because I'm going to jail knowing that I know I did something really terrible. And I know I have to pay. And so to me, that was very inspiring. And he went to jail, and he wrote us many beautiful letters. And he came back out, and we did a reentry circle for him to welcoming back him into the community. And we did a support circle for him and his family. And since then on, I think this young man never looked back. He's left the street, and he's been working with many other young men and women who are on the street just like him and want to make a difference in their life as well. The ideal is that this circle process is that we can really help people be accountable of themselves and each other as long as they know what they are accountable for. And not to say that it's a quick fix or it's a problem solving or to say that this person should not go to jail, but to kind of look at crime as the way that people kind of live their life in balance. And so how is that we as a community can be accountable and be supportive to help this young man or this young woman and all our community members to live their life balance. And that needs a holistic of community to come and support and to hold on and to give in and to be accountable ourselves as a community member as well. So that when this person are coming out of prison, that he or she is not coming back to our community very angry, not knowing why they're in there for, or just very get more angrier before they even get in there. And so we as a community have to take the end result of those consequences. And so the question is for us is, how do we help people to go to jail in a good way? And how do we help people to come back into our community in a good way? And how do we do that as a community? And so it's not like individual accountability, but a holistic accountability, because we as a community has a responsibility to bring balance to people and to community so that we have a safer and a healthy community.
Surumpong Street Work Director with Roca Inc. Later this year, Boston judges will give offenders who have pleaded guilty the option of going to a circle session to be sentenced by the community. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.